Motherhood has, to me, been an experience of constantly drowning. The misogyny is a recurring theme, and I've become so accustomed to my rage at my husband that I don't think I even notice it anymore. But it's not just him. It's how everyone treats us. And by us, I mean mothers. It's the assumption that I'm dumb, boring, irrelevant, that my sole worth is as a mother, an activity and role society deems worthless. And that's to say nothing of the total lack of support and community. I feel deeply lost, and all I can do is hope I find myself again if I'm able to launch these kids into adulthood. Hi, I'm Zahn Vilines. I'm a writer and feminist activist, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. I'm here today with my amazing guest, Beth Barry. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Zahn. I'm so happy to be here.
I am so happy to have you. Beth is awesome. So, Beth Barry is an activist, a coach, and the author of Motherwhelmed: Challenging Norms, Untangling Truths, and Restoring Our Worth. She writes about how to break free from the cages patriarchy puts us in, step into our power, and make lasting change in the world. She's an expert at building relationships and community, which to me is like her superpower because it's something we desperately need at this moment. But it's kind of hard to sum Beth up in just a biography because she's kind of doing like a lot of everything. And I think that the best way to describe her is just sort of a lifelong activist. So, Beth, tell me about your work. How do you see yourself and your role in the world and in the feminist movement?
Thank you for that. I see my role changing somewhat in this moment. I've kind of reached this place. I'm 47, and my kids are launched as of a couple of weeks ago. My youngest graduated high school, and if you'd asked me a couple of years ago, I would have given you a different answer. I might have said something like, "I'm here to advocate for mothers to help sh reshape the narrative around motherhood, help really reroute us in a narrative where, like, really center mothers as what I see as the powerhouse of the healing movement, honestly, if we know that about ourselves and we're well resourced and such. I still believe all of those things. What's changed is that I feel a little bit, for better or for worse, like I'm outgrowing a bit of the revolutionary energy that I've been operating from and living my life from for decades. Mostly I'm tired, and I know I'm not alone in this, but there's also this maturation process that's happening where it's like the revolutionary in me is giving way to something that feels a little less outward, a little more like, okay, I want to teach, I want to write, I want to be more contemplative and introspective and take walks in the woods, but I want my circle to feel smaller. I want my, like I want to take the what has been this huge circle of interest and, feeling like I needed to fit my circle of influence, like make it bigger and bigger to fit my circle of interest. Now I want to shrink my circle of interest and also shrink my circle of influence so that I also can feel good day to day and f feel well resourced, even though the hormonal changes are happening and even though my kids have launched and I'm reforming identity. So it's changing.
I mean, that's a lot of change, but life is kind of flux and change. It's interesting that you say that though, because so I'm more in early motherhood. My kids are little, but I am also like you, a lifelong activist, and I also feel a little bit of a shift in my approach to activism, and I kind of wonder if it's less the cycle of a mother and more the cycle of an activist, and I don't know. I don't have a lot of thoughts on that, so it's okay if you don't, but I'm curious what you have to say about that.
I like that question because it has me wondering too in this moment. I think that you're right about that. That has been my experience. Just hearing you say that, I can feel it in my body that there's truth there, that I've been through enough cycles where sort of having my ass handed to me and learning and growing and expanding and then feeling this, feeling lots of external pressure. A whole lot these days of pressure to take on even more as an activist, to include even more topics, even more people, to the point where there is my capacity has just been shot, you know?
Yeah.
And it feels like it devalues and you know, it's kind of like invisibilizes my humanity, just like motherhood, the story of modern motherhood, very similar actually, where it's like, hey, I too am a human with limitations, but somehow there's this expectation of people with big hearts and lots of passion and platforms for doing this work that we're supposed to just have like limitless capacity and resources. And it's just not true. And I think it wears a lot of people out. And it in activism so often it feels like it's meant to be outward. And it's always interactive with the world. But I do think that there is this call back inward to let ideas stew longer. And that's really what I'm craving. I used to write all the time. Like that was how I got started in the kind of work that I'm doing. And the bigger my business has got, the more I've had to focus on business, which I don't even care about. And the less I've been able to write. And yeah, so I think you're right about that, that it is the life cycle of an activist and the life cycle of a mother. I think those two are kind of converging in my world right now.
Yeah, okay, so this is not at all the conversation that like I prepared to have with you, but I want to run with this a little bit because I've been thinking a lot about like what it means to be an activist, what it means to be an activist right now, like my parents and grandparents were activists, so this is like really activism has always been a part of my identity. And, you know, it's been interesting to me to see the cycles of activism where people get activated and then it kind of like dies down a little bit and some people remain at it. And, you know, I think the hope is that with every cycle of activism, you get more people who stay activated. And I think that is generally true. But what has been really striking to me is that my work is overtly political, as is yours. But a lot of feedback that I get from people is that I am not sufficiently political. And I think that there's this really strange thing that happens where only certain kinds of issues at any given moment get deemed political. And then everything else matters less. And I think what we see over and over again is that mothers' issues are depoliticized. And, you know, that's not politics. That's trivial. That's silly. And we take these highly political issues and we put them back on the individual, which of course just keeps the cycle of oppression going. I got this super weird email from someone right around the election who like wanted me to talk more about Project 2025, which like fine, you know, that's important. But they closed their email with, "You act like politics don't fucking matter." And it was so enraging because it's like, how do you not understand that the way that we treat women and children is political, and that pretending that it's not political is like a weapon of oppression? So I don't know. I'm not sure how to wrap up this question. Like, say something to me about that.
Yeah, I just really appreciate you posing it. And I guess what I would say is that there's this other convergence that I experience often, which is that yes, the work we do is political, but I'm also at the core. Working, my angle is to help women feel, mothers feel more and more empowered through their own personal growth and development, but also their journey toward self-compassion. And so that piece, that's the biggest rub that I see is as you're becoming more political and or more of an activist in the world, there's less and less space for the self-compassion. And so those two things feel like they're counter to one another. And for me, the sweet spot has to be where both of those can exist. Kind of like how, you know, Prentice Hemphill talks about, you know, the boundaries are, need to be drawn where I can love myself and you at the same time. That's the sweet spot that if I can be in my good work that I know that I feel I'm called to do in the world. But I'm also caring for myself truly because I deeply love myself now. Like I've worked hard to get this to this place where I have a really beautiful self relationship. unapologetically, partly and rooted in the desire for my children to love themselves. That's how it started for me. And I'm not willing to compromise that piece anymore. And it feels like that's at the core of everything that's a worthy revolution is this self-compassion piece. We need it so desperately in the world. But that's, it's not outward enough. It's not feisty enough. It's to satisfy people who want activism to be all outward. And I'm not playing along anymore because it doesn't actually feel like wisdom to me.
I mean, the focus on outward activism is really interesting to me. We were my so my husband is a civil rights lawyer, and we were at this award ceremony back in April or May for attorneys who had worked on like civil and human rights sort of stuff. And there was a Black woman speaker there who talked about how Black women activists have always been able to seek rest and pleasure because they feel generationally connected to cycles of activists. And, you know, while it's probably an oversimplification to say that, I do think that, you know, when you're newer to it, when you're less chronically exposed to oppression, there can feel this sense of urgency to like do it all right now. My friend Desiree Stevens, who I've interviewed on the podcast, is this a decolonization counselor, and she talks about how one of the core tenets of white supremacy is this sense of urgency and this sense of perfectionism that, like, we have to do it, we have to perform it. You know, you can't spend time in the garden. No, you can't read. No, you can't take a bath. Do it now, now, now. And that this is born of the idea that activism is like a limited purpose thing rather than like an intergenerational project that has to span decades and centuries. And I've been trying to remind myself of that more lately, the whole idea that like we need to rest so that we can continue to have value and because we have value.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think what you said about, especially when we're newer to it, when we're newer to anything, we haven't matured our craft. And as that happens for me, as I do feel seasoned in some areas of my life, it that I take really seriously. The maturation process is something that we as a culture have lost touch with. You know, one of the
Yeah.
things that I see is that, you know, we're stuck in an adolescent phase of development culturally. That's part of the problem. That's like the core of the problem is that we don't have many true elders out there who are in positions of power because we don't revere elderhood. So those of us who feel the pull into true elderhood, I think we have a responsibility to shift this narrative around activism or whatever we're passionate about and allow whatever it is that we're a part of to mature and allow ourselves to mature within whatever that is, because that's what's actually needed is the mature versions of all of these things.
Yeah, that's so important. And I've enjoyed seeing your work shift more toward talking about mature motherhood. Because even though like my kids are young and I'm not really there yet in my motherhood journey, the thing that I talk about all the time is that feminism, activism, whatever label you want to put on the movement, has a really significant ageism problem. And this is one of the reasons that, you know, people don't listen to mothers and that younger women don't heed the lessons their mothers learned. And so as a result, we have mothers who just kind of repeat the same cycles and make the same mistakes and have the same types of abuse because they're not getting the information from mothers. So what I would like to know, since you're a little bit further in your motherhood journey, what lessons are newer mothers missing out on from more seasoned mothers as a result of this sort of divide of generations and ageism? Like, what should we be hearing? What do we need to know?
Yeah, well, what's tricky about this one is that I think most seasoned mothers I know who are on a growth and healing path, or that's a key component, who aren't just coping in ways that they haven't examined. We kind of joke because I facilitate groups of women who've been on the journey for a while. And sort of this, everyone is so relieved to be in a group where they can speak freely about what a shit show they've been through and how imperfect it is, and how, again, how much they've had their ass handed to them, and how normal that is, and how little control we actually have. But the struggle is that when I also work with younger mothers, newer mother, women who are newer to the mothering journey, and it's really tough to you want to hold encourage them to hold on to their optimism and this feeling like, yes, if I do enough things right, I can have some effect on the outcome for these kids, because that is also important to hold. But I think that a real lesson is you have a lot less control than you think, and you can get most of it right, and your kids will still not turn out anything like you thought they might. It's just not how it works. But that's a real hard pill to swallow when you're early on. Hopefully that can be a relief to some mothers that, like, it's yes, it matters, like where your kids go to school. It doesn't matter as much as you think it does. Yes, it matters what you feed them. It doesn't matter as much as you think it does. And it just like, it's tough too for parts of me, even in this moment while I'm saying it, because I have real strong idealist parts that also have matured and have relaxed, because they were actually causing me harm. But those idealistic parts come in and they're like, don't say that. We need all those young idealistic mothers. They're essential to the cause. And that's also true. So it gets a little tricky. When the thing I would say is a lot of what you're doing isn't going to really make that much difference. Like, I feel like a cynic, and I'm not a cynic. It's just my experience that we have less control than we think.
There's so much perfectionism, and I love it that as parents, mothers are generally becoming more mindful of like how we talk to kids and how we can nurture their emotions. But I also see with the rise of gentle parenting this like really extreme perfectionism of you have to get this exact perfect script. I have this friend who is just a wonderful, amazing mother. I mean, you can just like learn so much by watching her, but she is so anxious about getting things right with her kids that she will like write out scripts before she talks to them and then just beat herself up if she says literally the wrong word. And it seems so destructive to me.
I agree, and that's where that self-compassion piece, we really need that to come into play, and we need to our kids actually need to see us mess up and then repair, because they need to know what that looks like. They need to see us as human and imperfect. But it's true, we have such a fear of traumatizing our children. It's like the greatest fear of the modern mother, and it's really unfortunate that that's been sort of an unintended byproduct of all the, child development psychology, all of which is beautiful and important. But I think that it's like a pendulum swing. We've gone way too far in one direction where we think that if the more we know, the more we can control. And I think I just always come back to this. Almost every conversation I ever have comes back to most of these issues would lessen or go away if we had community support, more community support for raising kids, because the hypervigilance and the perfectionism, so much of it is rooted in I'm the only in this story, I'm the only one tracking the needs of these kids in the whole world. And if I don't get it right, no one else will, and we'll fuck. Like, that's immense pressure. And then we're also like, there's this mandate of the modern mother to not allow any trauma to be passed to your kids, which is actually not real. Like, we can't actually control for all of those factors. Many things we can influence, but I think it's really it's like another misogynistic tool. It's another way that we're kind of keeping women in boxes by saying, okay, and now you you have all this information about how to do it well and you have more resources. So you better get it right, because if you traumatize your kids, that's like the ultimate way to like lose your worth as a woman.
Oh, yeah. Well, and men don't feel this pressure. Like, men just show up and get praised for, literally not murdering their kids, and sometimes for murdering their kids. Oh, he was such a good dad before he just snapped. It's wild to me, and I think that we need to pay more attention to what are the pressures on mothers that are not on fathers, and what is the real purpose of this? Like, what role is this perfectionism playing? And is it really in service of our kids, or is it just a way to keep us oppressed and keep us from doing whatever our life's work is going to be?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that that's an inquiry that we all need to be active with and staying in touch with throughout our lives, because the perfectionism shows up at different in different ways in different seasons. I'm already having to work with this one around future grandmotherhood, because with it's like the anxiety around trying to get it right around my kids, as there are less outlets for that now that my kids aren't even home. I'm starting to think about, and this is something I'm actively working with, but there's stories in me now about who I need to show up as a grandmother. How do I need to adjust my lifestyle so that I can be the best grandmother possible, in part to take some of the burden off of my children, who will potentially all be mothers one day, knowing how fucked it is for mothers out there. I'm now like, okay, now what's going to happen with this next generation of grandmothers? We're all going to be perfectionistic in our grandmotherhood, I'm afraid, because we're trying to take some of the burden off of the next generation, that with these unrealistic expectations that are even higher than what we had. And the cycle will continue like that until we really consciously interrupt it. And I think so much of interrupting it is coming together with other people in a similar life journey and doing this deconstruction work with each other, because that's where I think there's real power. It's when we're doing it in our silos, isolated, that it is just expending so much of our energy.
Oh my God, I didn't even think about grandmotherhood and that's coming and all the perfect, like, it's never going to end, is it? It's yeah, that's pretty rough. I had this interesting discussion in the car with I have a second grader this morning. And I was like telling her about you and that I was going to be interviewing you today. And she's like very interested in feminism because she knows that that's my work. And she knows that her dad and I have like a truly equitable relationship and is very curious about like what it's like in different families that aren't like ours. But we've just come out of this cycle where my husband was having to work like 100-hour weeks, truly. And so we had about 2 weeks where I was kind of having the experience of being the full-time mother and the working mother and not getting a lot of support from him. And so we were talking about that, and I was saying, that's kind of more of what it's like in other families, and can you think of some reasons that that would be bad? And she's like, well, you can't garden and you can't read and you can't see your friends, and that's not good. And I was like, yeah, I was like, I really like spending time with you, but I also like spending time with myself, and I think that helps me, and I hope that doesn't hurt your feelings. And she goes, no. And I hope that this doesn't hurt your feelings, but I think you're really best when you're putting about 60 to 70% effort in instead of 100%.
Wow, that's quite the astute observation for a second grader.
And I was like, yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. I think I need to do other things and not have you guys be, my sole focus other than work. And she was like, yeah, well, I'm glad daddy's back. And then she's like, can we get donuts? Yeah, it's just wild. Community is the like hot button issue that I'm seeing with so many friends. Why are we so isolated? How did this happen? Why is this happening?
Yeah, I think most of us can see how all of the virtual connecting we're doing, or connecting, air quotes, is contributing, because it's sort of giving us this shallow satiation of the longing. And what it's doing is, like, it's kind of like if you have a whole population that's starving to death, and then you just start feeding them all junk food. They're now kept alive. Everyone's getting some calories. But if you haven't seen or been exposed to what nourishing meals and nourishing food is like, you might say, okay, well, we're being fed. Like, what else is there? Is this junk food the only way that it is? A lot of us have memory of our many of our connections not being, or a time when social media wasn't even a thing. But we're, it's like we're addicted to the thing that is satiating us in a shallow way. It's like we're addicted to the junk food type connections. So I think that's a big one. But I also think that we have lost skill sets, just like most of us don't know how to, make baskets or sew quilts, whereas 2 generations ago, a lot of people did. We've lost the skill set of community building, that it wasn't modeled for us. We didn't see it growing up as actively as previous generations did. And we're also becoming, in this world that is so overstimulating, we're reverting to coping strategies, many of which are protective, and, like, distrusting. If everything out there is vast and overwhelming, and especially if we're on the introverted side, it's so much easier to just sort of stay home and get those needs satiated in a shallow way than to build the muscles, because it requires immense vulnerability. So I think that's, it's some of it anyway. I really do think we've lost a skill set. Also, we are so conditioned to move in the direction of comfort, and meeting new people and building community is inherently awkward. And we have, like, demonized awkwardness as if it's the worst thing ever. But I don't actually think that any of us is going to get to the kind of connection and community that we crave without it. We have to be willing to be awkward together, and, put ourselves out there in awkward ways in order to go, get to where we want to be. And that includes in admitting our need. Like, we actually do need things from each other, but that feels so vulnerable, because if I admit that I need something from someone else, that I can't meet all my needs myself, then what happens when that person doesn't meet my need? It can feel crushing, because, again, we just don't have, we're not well resourced in general with the things we need to be thriving, and so the resiliency isn't there if we have that crushing disappointment when we put our needs out there and someone is not able to meet the needs. We don't have the resiliency we need to be okay, so we just as soon not try.
That's
That's a
yeah,
little.
I hadn't even thought about that, but I think that definitely tracks with my experience. It's so awkward meeting new people. Like I'll prepare like lists of things to ask people and just feel like such a weird loser, like interacting with new people. And I think a lot of us, especially if you're more introverted like me, feel that way and feel judged and concerned. But I had this really interesting experience this year with my daughter is neurodivergent, and that has like really taken up a lot of our time. And she's finally kind of like starting to settle into her class and having like play dates with friends. And she's got this one friend whose mom like decided to like court me as a friend. And it's an experience I haven't had a lot. But like we went over there for a play date and she just like sat down at the table and like talked to me and started asking me like rather intense questions about like my life and my work and what I like. And so we've like become fairly close friends, but and that's been lovely, but it's also made me sad because I've realized this is not something that is common. Whereas I know that both of my grandmothers had tons of friends and were constantly like gossiping and spending time with people and having intense lifelong emotional connections. And we just don't. It's just, it's so sad.
Is. It's very sad. And that kind of bumps up against another big hurdle, and that is that we are so immature as a culture when it comes to dealing with grief that we bump up against that sadness, and then it's a deep, deep grief for the state of the world and the fact that we're not connecting as humans and we don't know how to be friends anymore. Like that is worthy of grieving, but we don't know how to grieve in healthy ways. So we avoid
No.
that too. And then it just all gets even more muddled inside of us, and we just don't know where to go. I love people who are good at courting friends. I love the folks who unconsciously or consciously will use their gifts to make friends and bring people together to be friends. I think it's a really, really needed skill set. I'm sort of calling to the extroverts out there and saying, we need your help.
Yes.
We need you to be connectors. And so many people are really, I would say, I think it's a reasonable assumption. If you're in a narrative like, oh, these people, they don't want to be my friend. They already have their friend group. I actually think it's a reasonable assumption that most people don't have the community and sense of belonging that they're longing for. So I think if we start from that place to assuming that actually people could use more friends, most people could use more friends. I think that's a healthier place to start. I had one of my closest friends now. The way that we became friends is that we had kind of crossed paths here and there in the dance community and song circle communities, and hadn't ever really spoken. But we had friends in common who each of whom said, "Hey, you ought to meet Molly. She's wonderful." And so she walked up to me one day at an event and said, "Hey, I've seen you around and I've heard your name and I have a friend crush on you.
Oh,
And I wonder if you have space in your life right now for a new friend." And it still like brings tears to my eyes because it was vulnerable on her part. It was bold and it was totally effective. I did have space in my life for a new friend. And we have become dear friends. That won't always work because it's not always the right fit. I think when that something like that happens, again, we've got to build the resilience to be able to handle it so we're not crushed if it doesn't work.
yeah.
But the beauty of that is that if we're doing that with enough of the right people or the people who we feel like we might be aligned with, some of them are going to stick. It's going to work some of the time, and we don't need a ton of good friends. I don't think that I think that's a bit of a misnomer around when we talk about like building community. That in and of itself feels daunting. Start with a friend, a good friend. But I think we would benefit from thinking of building friendships more like we do dating, that it takes sometimes a while to go through many people and figure out, I like this, I don't like this. This feels like a compatibility. Oh, I have chemistry with this person, but not so much this person. And then if we can depersonalize that process a bit and move through it more quickly, I think we would all be better off. That we tend to like take things really personally when we're trying to make friends, but it's in the dating world, that's totally normal. That you might have to go through several people or a lot of people before you find someone who really feels like a right fit.
I love it that you mentioned dating because we have a lot of established rituals around dating. You ask someone out, you have your first kiss, you decide if you're going to be monogamous, maybe you move in together. But we don't have friendship rituals past childhood. I see with my two kids, my toddler has just recently gained the capacity to ask other toddlers that she encounters, like, do you want to be my friend? And my 7-year-old does it too. We were with some kids on Sunday, and she asked this little girl, "Do you want to be friends?" And the little girl said yes. And then they hugged each other and like jumped up and down, and they were like, "It's official. We're friends now." And I like we don't do that as adults. We don't wear friendship necklaces, and we don't, ask people to be our friends. I think we're often afraid of even acknowledging that we want to be friends with someone. We have no structure about how to get friends.
Yeah, and I actually think that ironically, part of what's going on here is that deep down, we know as women that our friendships, our sisters, our true sisters, are the most important thing. Like I feel like it's one of the deepest buried longings in most women. But most of us have grown distrustful of each other because we've been conditioned through the patriarchy not to trust one another. We've buried that longing so deep within us. I actually think that, hopefully there'll be more and more research that comes out about this stuff, but I would really like to know more about how epigenetics comes into this. And I've not done a lot of research around this, but going back to, if we're going to look at like the witch hunts, part of the weaponization was women against women. It was turn in going to women and saying, who are the healers in this community? Who are the wise women? Who are the birth workers? If you don't out them, tell us who they are, we'll take your children.
Yeah.
Like, that shit happened. That shit's real. It's not even that far back in our history. So epigenetically, could that also be playing a part in our resistance to trust one another? I think it's possible.
I think we've always kind of weaponized motherhood in that way too. Like there's this competitive, performative motherhood culture that often like supplants actual relationships. But yeah, like I hear what you're saying about epigenetics, and it's got me thinking. I have like a lifelong best friend who we were intensely close as children and into early adulthood, kind of mirroring a lot of the norms of like a romantic relationship of like she's my only person and I love her so much and all of that. And then we started dating and got married, and like we were still like best friends, but it was different. And it felt hard. Like I didn't feel very connected to her for many years, and our conversations didn't feel natural. Like it just got weird. And now we're at this stage where we both kind of like acknowledge that it got weird and that we don't really know why, but that we're like actively trying to build it again. And it kind of feels like that cycle of repair in a romantic relationship where it's like, oh shit, like we've drifted apart, like we need to fix this. And going through that with her has made me think about how we center our romantic relationships and we don't do that with our friendships. So it's worth struggling for a romantic relationship. It's worth going to therapy to save a romantic relationship. It's worth, yelling and fighting and working through conflict for a romantic relationship, but it's like if you're mad at your friend, it's just done.
Yeah, it's so true, and it's really so unfortunate and deeply sad because often that's when one or both people is growing and outgrowing the model and actually maturing. Like we're again, like we because we don't value maturation in the culture, we also don't value it within a relationship.
Yeah.
If one or both, the relationship may not need to end. It may need to evolve into its more mature version. And we are terrified of that. because it means change in an unknown direction. So again, we don't have the resiliency or the vulnerability tools to be able to stay with it as it evolves. And so we drop it. And again, I just can't help but think that part of the reason we drop it so quickly is because it's like it's what we want the most, but because it's what we want the most, it's the thing we feel most vulnerable around. Like on some deep, deep level, we know that we are not okay without our sisters. But that is incredibly vulnerable to make that known, especially in a culture that doesn't value sisterhood either.
Yeah. I mean, that was my experience with my friend is it was we would get into a push-pull thing where one of us was putting in more effort than the other one. And I felt like for most of the time it was me. She probably has a different perspective. And I remember I would get upset and I'd be like, you know what, I'm gonna cut her off. I'm not gonna talk to her anymore. Like I cannot deal with this stress. And, you know, feel very righteous about that. And now I'm really glad that I didn't, because my reasons for wanting to do that were like really kind of stupid. And again, rooted in that vulnerability of like I can't sit with this discomfort of things not being good with her right now.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the places where boundaries work is misused.
Yeah, yes.
You know, we're using that one as a vulnerability avoidance tool. When I think there are ways to misuse boundaries work. Boundaries work is essential. We all need to work on figuring that out. What is it to hold healthy boundaries? But it is also a good hiding place. Can
Yeah,
be.
it's so the boundaries thing. I've been thinking about this, the question I'm about to ask you a lot lately, and haven't raised it with anybody, so it's probably not well formed. But I have this really wonderful mother-in-law who I'm very close to. She's in her mid-70s and has like I think she's kind of like a prototypical baby boomer in many ways, and in one of them is that she's very upset about the younger generation asserting boundaries. And no one's really drawn any boundaries with her. She just has it in her head that this is a problem. And she told me a couple of weeks ago when we were getting ready for some kind of family gathering, and keep in mind, no one has asserted any kind of boundary against this woman. She's not a boundary violator. She's great. But she looks at me and she goes, "If anybody draws a boundary at this party, I'm leaving." And I just started laughing and I said, "Peg, that is a boundary." Like, you have just drawn one. And it's funny and, you know, different generational vocabularies. But what I keep going back to in thinking about that conversation is that my mother-in-law is great at relationships. She has so many friendships. Everywhere she goes, she builds community. And so she must be on some level, like, good at boundaries, even if she hates the word. And I just wonder if we are so quick to be like, well, they said the wrong thing, they did the wrong thing, they parented it away in a s that I slightly disapprove of, like they're cut off. If this is the problem, I mean, my opinion is that we need to be much quicker to cut off our romantic partners, because those are the people who pose the real danger to us, and much slower to cut off other women, because like there's not really an epidemic of like women killing and raping other women.
No, I completely agree with that statement. It's so interesting you bring this up, and what a great story. Because I've been thinking more and more about this, because I'm in this like little window. I imagine I will be a grandmother within for sure the next 5 years, but maybe like 2 years. So it's coming, and I think a lot about the way in which what I'm starting to see is that in, our generation of mothers, this is the first generation that has had this boundaries framework, that overtly, what maybe there were versions of it. But it's talked about a lot. It's a hot topic. It's used, I think, immaturely. Again, we're young at this skill set. You haven't really developed it well. Many people are using it in a pretty kind of adolescent way. It takes a while to mature any skill set. And there are a lot of grandparent relationships that are being affected right now by the boundaries concept. A ton. And it's this really tricky and messy convergence of boundaries work and extremely high expectations and perfectionism, really. So when you had a different template for what it was to be a quote unquote good parent when our parents were raising us, and the template is entirely different now. You have to do and be so many more things now to be considered a good mother, at least. And we also now have all this trauma awareness, and we have all this boundaries language that we're now weaponizing against our parents, the grandparents of our kids. And some of it is appropriate. Not the weaponization necessarily, but the utilization of the boundaries, because there is truly harmful behavior. Some of it is us projecting our perfectionism on them. And what I really, really dislike about this is that, as I was talking about earlier, when you asked what would I say to younger mothers, it's those older mothers, those grandmothers, they have figured some things out that you can't see yet when you're younger in the journey. Like, you don't have as much control as you think. And your perfectionism isn't actually going to get you very far. It's just making you miserable. And now it's cutting you me off from my grandkids. So I actually completely understand where the frustration is coming from on the part of grandparents right now around this boundaries conversation, because I think a lot of younger parents aren't actually using the boundaries tools with the it's the combination of the boundaries work and the perfectionism that's really doing a lot of damage, as I see it.
So I have a story on this point that I think kind of like it represents it. So with my first daughter, well, with all of my kids, I'm kind of like a naturally oriented, like breastfeeding, like natural birth parent. And so with our first, we like published a list of rules for how we wanted our family to behave when I was in labor, and they were like, reasonable. I mean, it sounds nutty. There was probably some nuttiness there, but also reasonable stuff. And one of them was that, I was going to labor at home, and I would, let the parents know when I was in labor, and, don't come over, don't call constantly, whatever. And so we did that when I went into labor, and my mother immediately showed up at the house because she really couldn't stop herself. She just couldn't. She just had to come help. And my immediate reaction was to like be upset. And the additional context is that, my mother and I had a really great relationship. My mom was a really good, nurturing mom. If that were not the case, it would be different. If we were talking about someone who was coming over to like demean and abuse me, or to like, fake a good relationship. But, we had a good relationship. So, my husband met her at the door, and he was like, and I was like, let her in. And, she stayed for a while until I kicked her out. But I ended up being like really glad that she was there. And I could have like leaned hard into like, well, you violated my technical rule, and so now we're fighting, but I didn't. And, then we ended up transitioning to the hospital, and my mom had a rare disease that limited her ability to speak at the end of her life. So, in spite of that, she somehow managed to find her way to the birthing suite. It's a miracle. So she, wandered her way in, and, again, it's like we had told her not to come in, but I ended up being glad that she was there. And then, like, after my daughter was born, we had a lot of like breastfeeding difficulties, like so many people do. And, I remember thinking, like, man, I really wish my mom could like talk to me about this because she can't talk. And she came into the room, and she grabbed my breast and popped it into the baby's mouth. And then she like latched, and it was fine after that. We didn't have any more breastfeeding problems. And, I look back on that, and I think, it's really kind of inappropriate of her to like grab my boob like that. And there are lots of relationships where that would be a huge issue. but because we had a good relationship, I was okay with her kind of being inappropriate and like writing it out with her to see like what she could offer me. So, different people, different circumstances, but I do think that rigidity can be harmful, and I can see how if I was like super rigid with my mom, then I would have gotten a lot less of what she had to offer me.
Yeah, I love that story. It is such a it demonstrates so well this delicate line, because we when we're setting boundaries, we're brand new parents and we're setting boundaries with seasoned parents. We are inherently, yes, we might be cutting ourselves off from some harmful, interfering behavior that we anticipate. We are also cutting ourselves off from experienced parents, period. Like experience. And so I think we have to like, I think it's good to be a little more careful with how we walk that line and be a little more curious about, huh, how, what might they have to offer me? I don't have to figure all this out myself also. And so this is actually kind of at the core of why I now feel some anxiety coming up for me in this little window I have between, my last daughter having flown the coop and becoming a grandmother. And that is that when I think about, I consider myself a damn good mother. Very, very, also have done a ton of personal growth. If my kids come at me, sure that this language is problematic and everything, but this I'm just gonna speak freely. If my kids come at me with rules for how I can interact with them, with the baby, with the whole experience, I can already feel in my body that my defenses will come up because they don't actually know anything. They know nothing. I have 30 years of experience in this realm, and I've supported thousands of women, thousands of mothers, and I feel so angry that like that's the template that we're operating from is like the younger generations, because of all the information overload, have more actual wisdom than the people who've lived more life. I think it's harmful. I don't think it's helping us. I again, I want to be really careful. I have put a lot of boundaries in place with my own parents. So I want to just call one of these both and things. My parents, my own mother was really helpful to me when my kids were little. I'm so, so grateful. And there have been problematic behaviors since. So it is a both and, but I just encourage people to differentiate from the things you're going to read online about the best way to latch the baby and how to form healthy attachment, and what your mother or mother-in-law might actually know from 20 years of having done it.
I mean, I remember, so our third was born about 6 months after my mom died. So like I didn't have my mom. So it was my mother-in-law. And we have a good relationship, but there's, she's my mother-in-law, so there's like some distance. And I'm like in the recovery room after the baby's born. I was in labor for like 5 days. It was brutal. And Jeff, my husband, was like, why don't we bring my mom up? Because she's like a retired nurse. And he's like, I think it would just be good for you to like have another woman around. So I was kind of like, fine, whatever, I'll do it for her. But it turned out to be for me, like she got me into the shower and, did all the things that my husband was doing and helping me with, but like it felt different coming from another woman, and it felt different coming from like a mother figure. Like sometimes we just need to be mothered. And so I know that some people may get defensive, like hearing about, well, don't be so rigid with your boundaries. And the rule I would give is like, accept the annoying and the awkward and the imperfect. Don't accept the abusive or harmful. And you can have boundaries around behavior instead of people too. I think that's the way we handle that. If your parents are abusive, like no, they're not entitled to access to your kids, or if they're repeatedly violating your boundaries. But just as we as mothers have had the experience of being treated like we are dumb and incompetent and irrelevant, our mothers and our fathers and our grandmothers have experienced that after a lifetime of wisdom. So let's try not to treat them the way we're being treated.
Yep, I agree with all of that completely, and that we're not going to get all of this right either. You know, that how can we find more spaciousness and grace within this to try something and be like, you know what, actually, let's try something a little different and be in a communities of practice with each other, families of practice. Let it be messy. And absolutely, there are plenty of instances also when the boundary needs to be firm. It's both
And
and.
trust yourself to figure it out and to like correct if you're wrong. Like maybe you were too rigid or maybe you weren't rigid enough. I think we can always correct and we can always fix.
Yep. And also to recognize that part of the reason we're distrustful of this, a lot of people are distrustful of their parents in their interactions with their grandkids, is because they didn't have the same access to these frameworks and child psychology and all of that. But that doesn't mean that they're necessarily holding that as not helpful. They just don't always know.
Yeah.
Sometimes it just takes a little bit more patience than we are offering or giving.
All right. Well, I think that's a good spot to wrap it up. We usually do an advice question at the end, but you've actually answered already the advice question that we had. So I'm going to skip that. I'm going to put all of Beth's information in the show notes. You should absolutely buy her book. It's amazing, but it's not just her book, it's her communities and her work. Like, please check her out. You can find all of that information at zahn.substack.com or at liberatingmotherhood.org. And I will be back to talk to you guys again in 2 weeks. Thanks, Beth.
Thank you so much, Son. It was a real pleasure.